Good morning. I hope you had a wonderful weekend, and I'm glad to have you here. I have three quick announcements before we get started. Some of these apply more than others. The number one most important announcement is that make sure you bring some safety goggles this week. I was looking over the lab again, and this is a good one, man. We're going to have flames and vacuums and all kinds of stuff. So make sure that you have some kind of protection for your eyes. The second one is that in case you haven't reserved a class presentation element, try to do so by this Friday at 9. There's a small point thing that you get for reserving your element by this Friday at 9. If you don't know of an element, I can absolutely assign you one. If you're not sure if you have one, go to the website, look up your grades, and it should say under reserved class presentation element what your element is if you have one. And if you don't, there's still time. You can literally just email me and say, yo, all right, and pick one for me, or you can pick one with the ones that are left. Either way is totally cool. And then finally, I have changed my office hours a little bit. I was getting a lot of requests for an 8 a.m. office hour, which is totally cool. So now, Monday mornings at 8 o'clock, I'll have an office hour. My Wednesday at 11 o'clock is now by appointment only, so if someone's there, I will totally be there. But on the other hand, if no one's there, it's cool too. Any questions? Yeah.
Do you still have office hours at 10 on Mondays or down
here? Absolutely, still at 10 o'clock, that's right. So like Monday before class, and now Monday after class, 10 to noon, I'll be there. And then Wednesday, it's Wednesday at 10 a.m. and noon officially, but there's some wiggle room. And good morning. Any questions on any of this kind of stuff? We left off on Friday on an important slide, so I want to backtrack just a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about percents in this next section, and percents are always by mass. The easiest way to find the percent composition or percent of nitrogen, say, on the bottom, you take the molar mass of the compound. So this is nitrogen dioxide. If you add nitrogen, about 14, and oxygen, about 16 times 2, to bitter sig figs, you get 46.01 grams per mole. And that's the number that goes in the bottom. And then what you're looking at, the grams of it in the compound go on top. So you can see that in NO2 there's one nitrogen, so it's just 14.01. For oxygen, there's two oxygens, so we're multiplying the 16 number by 2. And you get then these percentages from there. The percentages should be very, very, very close to 100%. Sometimes if it's 99.99, it's okay because of the doubtful digit. But again, the bottom, molar mass, and the top, that portion of the element that goes into the molar mass. So 14 divided by 46, and for oxygen, it would be 2 times 16 divided by 46. Officially, they're percentages, but sometimes you'll see them in decimal form too, which is cool. We did this on Friday, but let's do it again. Let's at least talk about how you would find percent nitrogen in nitrogen monoxide. So again, in the bottom, you want the molar mass, one nitrogen about 14 grams per mole, one oxygen about 16 grams per mole. That's where this number came from. So to find percent nitrogen, this would go in the bottom, and on the top, you would literally have 14.01. One nitrogen in nitrogen monoxide is why there's one mass of nitrogen. So 14 divided by 30, and your calculator comes out to be 46.68%. Any questions on that? Okay, then the next thing we started getting into is what were the weight percentages of nitrogen and oxygen in dinitrogen tetraoxide. Now, why this is relevant is if you look at N2O4 long enough and you think about it in terms of NO2, all right, NO2, if you multiplied both of those by 2, you'd get N2O4. So 2 times N2, 2 times O2 would be O4. And if you go through the calculations to do it, you'll find that the percentages are the same for N2O4 as they are for NO2. Originally in chemistry, people wanted to identify compounds based on their percentages. But the problem comes in that the percentages can be the same for two compounds if the ratio of the molecules is the same. And these are quite different compounds. N2O4 is kind of a brown gas. NO2 is a colorless gas and stuff. So chemists need a way to find the different properties of a molecule based on more than just percentages. All right, we need something more than that. So this leads us into the way that we find the formulas. And to find a formula like NO2 or N2O4, we first start at what's called an empirical formula, which is the smallest whole number ratio. And then we'll work our way into what's called a molecular formula. Now, we talked about empirical formulas quickly earlier. It's the smallest whole number ratio of atoms. So, for example, H2O2, the H and the O both have twos. If you would divide both of those numbers by two, you'd get just HO. HO is the empirical formula of H2O2. An empirical formula is just the smallest whole number ratio. But you don't want to have fractions. So H2O, you can't divide 2 and 1 by one number to get something that doesn't have a fraction. Sometimes empirical formulas are the same as their molecular formulas, what they're really like. We'll talk about why this is relevant. So let's say that you and I are analyzing in the lab a compound with boron and hydrogen. And we send our compound away for analysis, and there's a place on 122nd and Killingsworth that actually will do this, and they're really well known in Portland. But anyway, I digress. We send it away, and we figure out that it's 81.10% boron. Sometimes if you only have one percentage, this is honestly a way to save money. If you know for sure that there's only these two compounds, you can calculate the percent hydrogen by 100 minus the percent boron. We can use this information to find the empirical formula of this boron-hydrogen compound. Like right now, we know it's a BXHY kind of compound, and we want to find what X and Y are, basically, at least in their whole number of amounts. So, what I would do on all of these kind of problems is that if you see a percentage, all right, turn those percentages into grams. The mole is the right-hand man of chemistry, right-hand person of chemistry, all right? It does like so much. And so, for example, if you wanted to turn this quantity into grams, let's assume we have 100 grams. So 81.10% boron would be 81.10 grams of boron. All right. Now, Greg decides to use 0.8110 grams. That's cool, too. All right. You don't have to use 100, but I like to think as little as possible. I know that seems weird, but lazy chemist. But anyway, so I just, turn this number into grams automatically. But you could use 0.8110 as well. And then, remembering what I said about moles, let's turn that number into moles of boron. So in the periodic table to 4 sig figs, boron is 10.81 grams. 4 sig figs goes forward, 7.502 moles of boron. Now, like I said, if there's only two percentages, 100 minus the first one will give you the percentage of the second one. So 18.90% hydrogen will become 18.90 grams of hydrogen. And again, dividing it by the molar mass of hydrogen on the periodic table, 18.75 moles of hydrogen is what we get out. And you're like, whoopee-doo, Russell, that looks really cool. But remembering, we're trying to find the, in this compound, the X and the Y, all right? And to a really rough version now, the X is 7.502, and the H is 18.75. And you're like, all right, cool, good. But none of the formulas we looked at in last week's nomenclature lab have weird decimals by them or three-quarters fractions or something like that. This is kind of a really, really rough formula, all right? And it's saying that for every 7.502 moles of boron, you're going to have 18.75 moles of hydrogen. But now that we have the rough version, we can clean this up. We want to get to whole numbers, all right? Falling apart. Anyway, we want to get to whole numbers of molecules. So what you want to do is take the bigger number and always divide it by the smaller one. So in this case, boron's moles is smaller. 7.502 is smaller than 18.75. So you can see what I kind of did right here. I divided both of these numbers by 7.502. That guarantees then that the first one is going to be just one mole, all right? And the second one, if you look at it, it's like 2.5 hydrogens for every one boron. So that's better. All right, now I have a BH2.5, and that's looking more like one of the formulas we saw last week. But again, chemists, you're going to see, really don't like using fractions if we can help it. So instead of 2.5 to 1, let's multiply it by 2, because 2.5 times 2 is 5. And if you do it to one side, you have to do it to the other. Empirical formula, B2H5. So the smallest whole ratio of atoms in this formula is 2 borons to every 5 hydrogens. And again, what we did, we took one of these percentages and we just turned it into grams, all right? And I recommend using just 100 grams so you don't have to think, but whatever you want to do is fine. Turn those grams into moles. So if you take this number and divide it by boron's molar mass, you get this number. And the value for hydrogen, 18.9 whatever, divided by hydrogen's molar mass gave us this number. And that is a type of a formula, but you need to clean it up. So divide both of the numbers by the smallest one, so 7.502. We then got to a 2.5 to 1 ratio, which is closer. And if you multiply it, B2H5.
Yeah. What'd you do with the 100 grams again?
Cool. The 100 grams is useful when you have the percentages, okay? So in this molecule, if we had 100 grams, 81.10 grams would be boron. And then 100 minus this number, which I think is 18.90, that would be the grams of hydrogen. And once you have those, all these formulas are like mole-based, okay? So if you see grams, like turn it into moles right away. So that was the next part. Good question. Yes?
How do you know the time to divide 2?
Cool.
Is there other numbers you can
divide? In the real world, all right, if you and I were doing it, what we might end up would be like a 2.25 or something like that. And does that mean if it's 2.25, you multiply it by 4 or something like that? This can be a pretty difficult thing, an experimental thing, because your sample may not be pure. In the examples we'll see, they'll be, I consider, obvious. So you'll see 2.5s. You might see 2.333, which would be 2 1/3. So you could multiply by 3. But nothing what I would consider to be crazy. In the real world, though, this is a big concern. The next step, when we take an empirical formula to a molecular formula, there is a way to kind of check and see if our answer made sense at this point. But absolutely, that's one of the questions. That if you're the first person to analyze this substance, you've got to be very careful at this stage. Good question. Now, just because we have the empirical formula, that doesn't necessarily mean we have the molecular formula. So for example, going back to H2O and H2O2, at this point, if it was H2O, we would have a formula of H2O and we'd be good to go. All right, we know that our formula and stuff like that. On the other hand, if we had a compound like H2O2, then the empirical formula would be HO. And instead of B2H5, we'd see HO, and we'd be like, we're not sure if this is the actual compound. Also, what Tammy brought up is really important. This going from the raw numbers to whole numbers can be a little tricky, all right? So all of these things play out in the next part. A molecular formula is kind of like the holy grail of the first midterm exam, all right? Getting to the molecular formula is really kind of a cool thing, because then you know you have H2O2, and you know you have H2O stuff like that. So this next step has many different purposes. First of all, it really is what we're after. We want to know what the molecule looks like. But second of all, it will also help us sometimes back on this step just to make sure that we're doing the right thing. B2H5 is our empirical formula. And our molecular formula is going to be some combination of B2H5s. So the answer we're going to have on this next step, it could be B2H5, like H2O is the empirical formula and the molecular formula. But it could also be twice B2H5. It could be B4H10. Remember, with H2O2, our empirical formula would be HO. So HO twice would be H2O2. This answer right here would be saying like B2H5 taken twice. But it could also be taken three times, four times, five times, etc., etc. These boron compounds, as well as aluminum and gallium, they do some weird kind of bonding. I called them the twisted metals the other day, and there's a reason for it. They're never totally happy. We're going to talk more about what these arrows mean in a future lecture and stuff, but just realize that boron does some kind of interesting things. And what we need to do now is verify what the actual compound is. So let's say that we have an empirical formula, an EF of B2H5, and we want to know its molecular formula. It's not a very hard process. I think it takes more words to describe than it actually does. But what we need is we need the molar mass of the whole compound using a mass spectrometer. And this is kind of interesting. Let's say that Brooke brings me something that she finds in her grandfather's garage, and she's like, Russell, what is this? Well, I don't know, and I'm not going to taste it, that's for sure. So what I would have to do is two experiments. The first experiment would be to find the percentages. I could find out what elements were in there, maybe carbon and hydrogen, but no uranium, all right? The second thing, though, I'm going to do a second experiment, and I want just the molar mass of the compound. How many grams per mole are in the whole thing? The percentages will lead us to the empirical formula, to this B2H5 part. And from the B2H5 and the molar mass of the compound, we're going to find this molecular formula. So what you need to do to figure out the molecular formula is you need to find out how many grams per mole are in this thing right here, this empirical formula. So what you can do is you'd add up two borons and five hydrogens, figure out how many grams per mole that is, and what you're going to do is compare the whole molar mass of the whole thing, the compound, which you get from the mass spectrometer, divided by the molar mass of the empirical formula, this thing right here. And if you've done it right, the answer will always be a whole number. All right? So if you get a ratio of 1 or 2 or 3, good to go. If you get a ratio of like 1.3, this would be a time that, going back to Tammy's question, I would go back to the empirical formula calculation. Should we have multiplied by 2.5 or something like that? So it's kind of another way that you can check to make sure that your answers are right. If you don't get a whole number right here, then something is wrong with your empirical formula or your sample is contaminated. Let's look at an example of how this works, because it's actually easy, but there's a lot of words involved. Here's an example of a compound. We found its empirical formula to be CH2. And CH2 is actually a fairly common empirical formula in organic chemistry. So this information right here came from percentages. We then did a second experiment, and we found that the molar mass of the whole compound, 28.1 grams per mole. Remember, if you see the little negative one right there, that means like 1/moles. So that's just a snobby way to write grams per mole, let's be honest. Anyway, we can use these two pieces of information now to find the molecular formula of the compound, the holy grail. What is it? Is it CH2? Is it C2H4? Is it C3H6? What combination of CH2s is this going to be? So what you can do, this is in the CH2, the 28.1 is from the other experiment. What you can do is you first need to find out what the molar mass of your empirical formula is. So in this context, we have one carbon and two hydrogens. This is carbon on the periodic table. This is hydrogen to the 100th on the periodic table, and we're multiplying it by 2 because of the CH2. The empirical formula's molar mass is 14.03 grams per mole. So the CH2 part has a molar mass of this part. This is the molar mass of the whole compound. If we've done it right, the whole compound divided by the empirical formula had better give us a whole number. If it doesn't, we have to go back and look at our data. In this problem, you can probably see 28.1 divided by 14.03 to 1 sig fig is a 2-to-1 ratio. That's the whole number we're looking for. And a 2-to-1 ratio right there means we need to have a 2 by the empirical formula. It's like two empirical formula units go into one molecular formula. So we take that CH2, we multiply it by 2, molecular formula, holy grail, C2H4. Now remembering that numbers like this, 28.1, are something you need from a separate experiment, and it would be given to you. You've got to figure out the grams per mole of your empirical formula, which comes from the percentage, do the ratio, get a whole number, that whole number times empirical formula, molecular formula. Any questions? Okay, let's try this out. There's all these carbohydrates, glyceraldehyde is one of them. Empirical formula, CH2O, molar mass of the whole thing, about 90 grams per mole. Let's figure out the molecular formula. So what we need here is we need that whole number ratio of the molecular to the empirical. And whatever that whole number is, we're going to multiply it by CH2O in order to get the molecular formula. Could we get answer E here? No, right on. The answer is going to be like this taken once, or this taken twice, et cetera, et cetera. And you can't get 1, 1, 1 from this empirical formula. So answer E here is kind of silly. But the other ones, I believe, are all legit. All right, 1 to 2 to 1, 1 to 2 to 1. So if you take this number, the 90.08 number, and you divide by the molar mass of CH2O, now, I'm going to recommend just kind of roughing out the value. You don't have to have like a lot of sig figs here. So you've heard me say several times, carbon's about 12, oxygen's about 16, and maybe hydrogen is about 1. And I do that because that's all you need to divide the 90.8 number by. So carbon at 12 plus 2 is 14. And 14 plus 16 from oxygen is 30. And if you take 90 and you divide it by 30, what will our whole number ratio be?
3.
3, yeah. And that 3 tells us how many empirical formula units are in the molecular formula. So if you multiply CH2O by 3, you're going to get 3 carbons, 6 hydrogens, 3 oxygens, still have that 1-to-2-to-1 ratio. C3H6O3 is how you find it. Any questions? Notice again, I know it's kind of schizophrenic, and I apologize. I made such a big deal of sig figs, especially in the first section. And now I'm saying, well, you know, kind of rough it out and stuff. I'm roughing it out because you do need just a whole number. All right, it's not like you have to have the exact. And it saves you time. All right, lazy chemist approach, blah, blah, blah. Any questions? All right, so going back to our original problem, all right, we calculated that we had an empirical formula of B2H5, and we want to find the molecular formula of the whole compound. You need a second experiment to figure out what the molar mass is of the whole compound. And this is something that would be given to you. It's nothing that you have to like figure out or anything. So in this problem, all right, 53.3 was found to be the grams per mole of the whole compound. We need to now figure out the ratio between this number and the ratio of the B2H5. So if you add up the B2H5, two borons, which is what the 10.81 number, plus five hydrogens, 1.01, you get this number right here, 26.67. And you take the ratio between the whole compound, which is the separate experiment, 53.3, you divide it by the empirical formula's molar mass, two borons and five hydrogens, the 26 number. And again, if this process has been done correctly, you're gonna see a whole number, all right? Won't be fractions, won't be a number less than one, definitely won't be negative. But anyway, 2 to 1 is what you see here. And this 2 is important because it means we need two B2H5s to make this compound possible. B4H10 is the name of the compound. Any questions? Remember that in my world, you know, chemists get paid for basically two types of things. Number one, what is it? And number two, how do you make it? All right. And what we're going through right now is what is it? How do you figure it out? And it's a two-step process, all right? You need the percentages to find the empirical. Then you need a separate experiment to tell you the molar mass of the whole thing. But this is how you can tell the difference between N2O4 and NO2, for example. You'd send it through. In the NO2 example, it would be a 1-to-1 ratio. So your empirical formula of NO2 would also be NO2 for a molecular formula. But N2O4, you'd see a 2-to-1 ratio. So 2 times that NO2 would give you the N2O4. Questions? Okay. So again, just kind of to overview this process, because it's kind of important. All right. First, what you want to do, turn your percentages into grams. All right. And I always use 100 grams because it's easy, but you can use any kind of ratio like that you want to. And once you have it in grams, turn it into moles right away. So the grams of boron we turned into moles of boron, and the grams of hydrogen we turned into moles of hydrogen. And then what you want to do is find the empirical formula. The bigger numbers were on the top, and you divide it by the smaller numbers. We automatically got 1-to-1 for boron, but hydrogen came out to be about 2.5-to-1. And then like we talked about over here, BH2.5 is okay, but chemists really hate fractions, i.e. turn it into whole numbers, okay? So we multiplied everything through by 2 to get B2H5. And again, this is sometimes the part that can be a little nerve-wracking when you're the first chemist to look at compounds, but there's a way kind of to double-check yourself at the end here. So B2H5 is the empirical formula, the smallest whole number ratio of atoms. And sometimes that's all you need. But to really knock this in, to really nail the coffin shut, we need to find that molecular formula. And to do that, we need a separate experiment. We need this number, the molar mass of the whole compound. That little silly box that's about $50,000 I was babbling about the other day, that would be the kind of box where you could figure out this kind of stuff easy, all right? It would plug it in, a number would spit out once you can read it and stuff that gives you that number. And you compare that number to the ratio, to the molar mass of the empirical formula. So two borons plus five hydrogens came out to be this number. This number, this ratio, has to be a whole number. Your answer is going to be some combination of B2H5. So it could be B2H5, B4H10, B6H15, etc. And because it was 2-to-1, taking the empirical formula twice, B4H10, home joy. Any questions? There's a lot of compounds in organic chemistry with very similar formulas. Like we saw the CH2O earlier, there's lots of those. There's also lots of CH2s and even some CHs. And so these processes become really important. In the metals and nonmetals, it's not quite as critical. But again, because organic is such a big part with biochemistry, it's kind of important. Any questions? Yeah. Cool. So what we did is we took two borons and we added it to five hydrogens using the periodic table. So like boron is like 10.8 or whatever. So two times that number plus five times about one for hydrogen, but I use better sig figs. All right. That's where that number came from. Good question. This next example is going to be similar to what we're going to do in lab this week. And in this week's lab, we're trying to find a copper chloride formula, all right? And copper chloride formulas and tin iodide fluoride formulas are pretty good. Copper is a variable charge metal, all right? We use a Roman numeral when we refer to copper with a compound. And so it's copper's fault in this lab, like why we don't know what the formula will be. And tin is the same way. When tin combines with iodine, there's a couple different combinations that can happen. So let's say you were curious what the state was here. Here's examples of taking tin. This is tin metal. And this black solid right here, this is actually iodine. And if you dissolve the iodine in some solvent, and I think they use methanol, but I'm not totally sure, it makes kind of a cool purple compound. But anyway, you add the tin in and you filter it. And this is an example of using filter paper. This is like a glass funnel, and you can put a piece of paper in there to extract out the solid. And when you dry it and stuff like that, this is the compound that forms. So the question here really is like, what is this kind of orangish compound? We're pretty sure it's going to be tin with iodine, but what combination? All right. If you look on the periodic table, tin is one of the metals under the metalloid line that's a variable charge metal. So tin, for example, is often plus 2, sometimes it's plus 4, occasionally plus 3. If we would have been using magnesium, we would have known it was always plus 2. And so magnesium and iodine would always be MgI2, magnesium iodide. But with tin, like copper in this week's lab, who knows, man, all over the place. But thank heavens for math and experiments. Woohoo! Anyway, I'm trying to get excited here, but my caffeine is not quite kicking in. Notice here what we've got. We've got some tin metal at the beginning. We put this much iodine in. And at the end, some of the tin was left over. All right? In this problem, we had extra tin. Not all of it was used up. All right? This is an interesting thing we're going to talk more about in the next section. But notice how all the iodine is gone. All right? Iodine here is what we're going to start referring to eventually as a limiting reactant. It's used up before the tin is used up. All right? And as a very cheesy example, let's say that I brought in 12 donuts, a dozen, and I said, here, go for it. I bet there's 12 people that would come down and take those donuts, but maybe there's a 13th person that wants a donut, all right? So the donuts here were the limiting reactant. They were used up. There's none left at the end, all right? And assuming all of you are hungry, and if you're not, you can keep yourself out of this argument, but the students in this case would be the excess reactant. But if I brought in 200 donuts and I said, go for it, all right? Probably 200 with a class this size would satiate everybody. No, if I'm wrong, I apologize, but go with it. In that case, then, the student's hunger was limiting, all right? It was used up first, and there would be extra donuts. So in chemistry, this kind of concept's really important. Iodine here is all used up. It's the limiting reactant. There's none of it left at the end. On the other hand, the tin, there is some left. We put in extra tin. So when we're going to do our calculations, we want just the 10 that was used up, all right? Beginning minus end. We don't want this amount of 10 in. That, in theory, we could recycle and use in another experiment. We'll talk more about limiting reactants, but it's an important concept when it comes to chemistry, and sometimes being able to predict how much of things you can make, you've got to know about this limiting reactant. Anyway, questions on that stuff before we go on? Okay, so back to your regular scheduled programming. All of this iodine was used, and this number minus this number is going to tell us the grams of tin that were used. And from those 2 grams, we'll turn them into moles, compare the moles in a formula. Good to go. So, 1.947 grams of iodine completely used up. By the way, iodine is one of the 7 diatomics. Have no fear of ice, clear brew, or whatever kind of version you want to use. These 7 are going to be super, super important to us coming up. So maybe make sure that you know these for this week's quiz. Oh, sorry, coughing, it's cold. No, I'm trying to give you a hint. All right, good. All right, pop that back on. Oh, I'm kind of all over the place this morning. Iodine here is listed as I2 because it's one of the 7, all right? If its element is not one of these 7, then you list it by itself. So it's not SN2. SN is not one of the diatomics, all right? But iodine would be I2, bromine would be Br2, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to figure out the amount of tin that was used up in the reaction. So if you take the before and after, the difference is what we want. That 0.455 grams, that's the amount of tin that was used up when this amount of iodine was used up. So now we've got the grams of tin that were used, and we've got the grams that were iodine that were used. Let's convert it into moles. And like I said in this section, basically, if you see grams, you probably want to turn it into moles right away. So if you look on the periodic table, tin is 118.7 grams per mole. Grams divided by grams cancel out. 3.83 times 10 to the minus 3 moles of tin. Any questions so far? The iodine, there's one little twist because of the diatomics. Now, iodine as I2 is the elemental version. When you have pure iodine, it comes as I2. But in a compound, so for example, tin and iodine, or carbon with iodine, or sodium with iodine, you don't want to think about I2s, you want to think about individual I's. So notice here what I did. I took the grams, I turned it into moles of I2, and I'm now going to take the moles of I2 and turn it into just I's. These 7 diatomics are what they're like when they're in their elemental form, all right? When you buy iodine from a maker, it comes as I2. But in a compound, like with sodium, or a compound with aluminum, you could have 2 iodines, but you could also have 3. And you could have 1 iodine, and you could have 4. So in a compound, you've got to get out of the elemental version and turn it into the regular individual version. So I'm multiplying by 2 here to get into just the I atoms, not the I2 pieces that come together. That's why these 7 are weird. All right, people will forget that there's 2 of them, and it can cause some weirdness. So. But anyway, now that you've got moles of tin and you have moles of just I, you want to find a ratio. We're kind of after an empirical formula here, all right? And when you look at these numbers, you want the bigger number on the top and the smaller number on the bottom. Now, these are powers of 10, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2. Is 10 to the minus 3 bigger or smaller than 10 to the minus 2? Smaller, right on. It's easy to get the positive versions confused with the 10 to the minus versions. A 10 to the positive 3 is bigger than 10 to the positive 2, but a 10 to the minus 3 is smaller than 10 to the minus 2. So keep that in the back of your mind. This number will go on the bottom. This number will go on the top. Prof that off. You can't remember which one is bigger and smaller. Let the calculator do the heavy work, man. If you get a number larger than 1, you've done it right. If you get a number that's smaller than 1, you need to go back and flip them. Prof that back on. So the ratio of those two comes out to be 4.01 divided by 1, because this number divided by itself is 1. This is awfully, awfully close to 4 to 1, so we have a good whole number ratio here of pieces. This compound, empirical formula, SNI4. This is a positive 4, 10. Iodide is negative 1. There's 4 negative 1 iodides for every 10 plus 4. So it's positive 4, 10, 4 iodide.
Woohoo! I simply respect chemistry. Chemistry must be respected. I apologize for being so transparent.
Breaking Bad was a show that people used to tell me all the time, oh, you must watch it, you're a chemist. And I went, oh, I don't know if I want to see the chemists being the bad guys. But once I did finally start watching it, I was like obsessed with it for a while. So anyway, this is a little blurb there about chemistry. And I put it up there not only to get a smile, but also because, yeah, if you follow these steps through, it's really, really good. Using the moles is so much more chill than other ways and stuff. And these mole ratios would be good. The 7 diatomics will come back once in a while to do some weird things. So keep your mind open to them. I think I saw somebody with a hand up there before. Yeah, Zeke.
Yeah, so I was wondering why you multiply by 2 moles instead of 5.
Cool. So this is a little weird. These guys come as 2s. So when, like for example, this chlorine is used, it comes as Cl2. But in a molecule, you don't have to have 2 Cls per whatever you're looking at. So for example, calcium chloride is an example of CaCl2, and you do have 2 Cls for every calcium. But hydrochloric acid, HCl, is just 1 Cl for every H. So if you're using the elemental form, which happened on this one, all right, all of these, when they come as two atoms per molecule, if you will. But when you're figuring out a formula for a compound, you've got to think about the number of individual chlorines, not the diatomic version. So when you're turning one of these into a formula, get just Cl, all right? Now it feels weird because we're dividing by molar mass of 2 and then multiplying by 2 to get them. But trust me, there's a reason for all this. I'm introducing something that'll come really important. But you ask a good question. In a formula, you can have any combination of chlorine possible. All right, so AlCl3, CCl4, carbon tetrachloride is an example. So all different combinations of these guys with other atoms are possible. It's only in the elemental form that you see them as 2. So the punchline is like, make sure you multiply by 2 to figure out how many you need per the base part, if that makes sense. We'll see this more often as we go through. I'm getting you ready for the next part. So if you now know how to identify a compound, the next thing will be like how to make the compounds. And when you figure out the formulas, you're gonna have different amounts than just 2. So that's kind of what I foreshadowed. That was a good question. Other questions? Okay, this is the end of this chapter, and this is kind of the end of this first section stuff before we do the midterm exam. Starting on Wednesday, we're going to go through a couple of days of midterm exam reviews, and I wanted to just highlight again some of these things on here with a few minutes we have left. When you're studying for midterms, like you study for quizzes, there is always a study guide, which is literally like a bulleted list in your companion that you you can see the things that I thought were important from these different sections. Concept guides are literally worked examples from these different sections. So if you want to see more examples of empirical formula to molecular formula, or how you can find the empirical formula, et cetera, et cetera, the concept guide would be a good thing. And then also brand new, and these literally are brand new, after these slides, I don't usually show them, but there's going to be like an overview of some of the things I think are important, and you can kind of skim through those and see. But then also there's a series of some problems, all right? And if you look at these and stuff, here's like this last one right here is an example of empirical formula, molecular formula. And notice here I'm using two diatomics, and I want you to find what the formula is of that whole compound using it. So again, what Zeke asked about earlier, you've got to turn the diatomics into individuals first to see. The answers of all of these are here on the back, so they should be cool. Any questions? All right, Wednesday we'll start some review for the midterm exam. I hope you have a great day. We'll stop a little bit early.